Good afternoon, everyone. This is Marvin Silver with Americans for Financial Reform. Thank you for joining today's briefing call on municipal finance, preventing exploitation of taxpayers and the public. We're going to begin our call in just a moment. Just want to provide just some brief instructions. After the presentations, if you have any questions, we encourage you to announce your name and which press outlet or office that you're with, so we may recognize you, and then please direct your question to one of our speakers or to all of the speakers. Following that, we will conclude our call. So at this time, what I would like to do is turn it over to our policy director, Marcus Stanley. Marcus?
Thank you, Marvin. As Marvin said, I'm the Marcus Stanley, the policy director of Americans for Financial Reform. I'm going to start out the call just by giving some of the substantive and policy and political background behind the municipal advisor and municipal fiduciary duty issue. And then we also have three distinguished speakers on our call. Lisa Lindsley is the Director of Capital Strategies for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, who of course have a deep interest in this issue. Frank Partnoy is the George E. Barrett Professor of Law and Finance at the University of San Diego. And Professor Partnoy is a veteran of these issues, both from the standpoint of having worked at a major Wall Street dealer in the 1990s and also as an academic following these issues associated with derivatives and fiduciary duty for well over a decade now. And finally, we also have Nathan Howard, who acts as counsel for the National Association of Independent Public Financial Advisors, who of course do public financial advisory services. So just to give some background on the issues that bring us together for this call, I think everyone here is aware that in recent years we've seen the revelation of very significant abuses of public debt issuers and public entities by Wall Street, by banks, by swap dealers and underwriters, and also by financial advisors generally. And those range from swap deals that may have been legal but were abusive in their terms and were very difficult for involved effectively risky speculation on the future direction of interest rates, that public entities were not sophisticated enough to fully either understand or balance the risks for themselves. And it turned out that a lot of those swap deals were very difficult to get out of and involved termination payments that were very difficult for put a lot of pressure on municipal finances. And we've also, of course, seen criminal activity in cases like bid rigging by the major Wall Street banks, in manipulation of the LIBOR interest rates that inflated the payments that municipalities had to pay. So that really just scratches the surface of some of the abuses we've seen, and we can go into plenty more detail if people would like. And the Dodd-Frank Act took, I think, a very straightforward approach to handling this problem. It essentially said that all those who give financial advice to municipalities owed a fiduciary duty to taxpayers for the quality of that advice. In other words, they had to put the interests of taxpayers first. And there were reasonable exemptions in the Dodd-Frank statute for certain kinds of professional advice, narrowly defined around an underwriting or around legal services. But in general, those who gave financial advisory services to a municipality would be responsible to taxpayers for giving good advice, which is just really ethical business practice. And we've seen a lot of difficulty, frankly, in finalizing and enforcing these rules since the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act. The Securities and Exchange Commission issued their proposed rule defining municipal advisors more than 2 years ago now, at the end of 2010. And this rule met significant opposition. And for some of that, the most important opposition was from dealers, big Wall Street banks, underwriters, swap dealers, who essentially wanted to be exempted on the grounds that the advice they gave during an underwriting, during a swap deal, they should not be held responsible for because they were simply a counterparty and not an advisor, even if there was advice involved in that deal. And there was other opposition around some other issues, such as the elected and the issue of whether members of elected and appointed boards should be counted as advisors. The SEC has said on that specific issue, elected and appointed boards, that they would not count those people as advisors in the final rule. And I think that the real crux of the issue here is around this question of whether banks and dealers are going to get an exemption simply because they're banks and dealers, and they claim that their work should come under some kind of professional exemption, even if they're giving advice. And this issue has also gone to the Hill. We've seen in the last Congress, H.R. 2827, and in this Congress, the same bill introduced as H.R. 797, which is legislation that would essentially say that a very long list of entities, including major Wall Street, all banks really, all underwriters, all swap dealers, would be exempted from municipal advisor registration and therefore exempted from a fiduciary duty for any advice that they gave that was at all related to or connected with a sale of a swap, an underwriting, any kind of bank financial services. It's related to or connected with language has historically been interpreted extremely broadly by the courts. And we can give you plenty of information and background information on just how broadly that language has been interpreted. but essentially what the effect of H.R. 797 would be to give a blanket exemption based on their status as banks, underwriters, swap dealers from the fiduciary duty owed to taxpayers. And since Wall Street banks, swap dealers, and so on have been at the center of many of these abuses that I mentioned, it would really undermine and take the heart out of the protection that was intended by the Dodd-Frank Act. So many of you may have seen that organizations including AFR, AFSCME, the AFL-CIO, and other organizations oppose H.R. 797. You can contact us, reply to the email that you got announcing this call, and we can send you our opposition letter and plenty of background information on that. But what we really need to see now is we need to see the SEC finalizing a rule that requires a fiduciary duty for any advice given to public entities, regardless of who gives that advice. In other words, base it on the activity of giving advice and not on whether you're an underwriter or a bank. And we need to see Congress step back and permit them to do that. So with that, I will pass it on to Lisa Lindsley from AFSCME to discuss the issue further.
Thank you, Morgan. I'm from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and our interest in the municipal advisor rules has to do with the fact that state, local, and county governments, which have lost billions, if not trillions, of dollars from being sold inappropriate financial instruments, those entities are the employers of our members, and we are the public service union. As a result of the financial crisis, which was caused not only by the inappropriate instruments being sold to these entities, but also, of course, by the foreclosure crisis, and had a lot to do with derivatives, which is one of the things we're trying to protect these folks from.
Let me know if this is, like, too loud.
There are 1 million fewer public service workers than there should be.
Right.
Than there would otherwise be. So this is fewer people, picking up garbage and driving school buses and performing all sorts of services that are the reason that we come together to form governments. The poster child for municipal advisors, you know, acting inappropriately and in conflicts playing out is Jefferson County, Alabama, which has been very well documented. But what you might not know is that also, you know, the Auditor General of Pennsylvania did a great study on all of the losses due to swaps, sold inappropriate swaps, sold to entities in Pennsylvania. Just the government of the city of Philadelphia lost over $100 million. Also, there was a study from New York State where they lost $100 million. The pensions public service workers get have been under attack for being underfunded. And this is due, of course, to the crisis. The value of their investments fell. But one reason the value of their investments fell so much is that they, too, invested in inappropriate asset classes because they were sold investments by advisors who had a conflict of interest. And I work quite closely with rank-and-file public employees who are elected to serve on the boards of public pensions. And, you know, we know that routinely municipal advisors hold themselves out as having a fiduciary duty when, in fact, they do not. And underwriters and investment managers also hold themselves out this way. So that's why we're very concerned. We strongly oppose H.R. 797. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Frank Portnoy.
Frank? Frank, we may have a muting error here. Nathan, why don't you go ahead and discuss the issue, and we'll see if we can get Frank.
Yeah, my name is Nathan Howard. I'm as Marcus said, I advise the National Association of Independent Public Finance Advisors. However, today, luckily for you all, I am speaking for myself, and these comments do not necessarily reflect the sentiments of the organization, so keep that in mind. But generally speaking, you know, the principal concern, at least from financial advisors with respect to this bill, is that what the bill does is fundamentally change the definition of municipal advisor from that which is in the Dodd-Frank Act. This is, you know, contrary to the sentiment which has been put out there that this is somehow merely a clarification of Dodd-Frank. The fact of the matter is there was no legislative record with respect to Dodd-Frank, and you know the only intent of the rule can be derived from the text of the legislation itself, and so, you know, without getting overly technical, you know, the fact of the matter is that they've changed the definition in some fundamental ways. One of which is they now require municipal advisors to be compensated in order for them to obtain fiduciary duties. Now, this fact, paired with, as Marcus stated, the changes to the exemptions for individuals such as underwriters, is particularly troubling. Because underwriters are now basically given carte blanche to do whatever it is they want to do in terms of presenting themselves to the issuer as the issuer's advisor. There is another portion of the law that I don't believe that's been touched on, and that is that the regulators will now be unable to regulate individuals such as underwriters and lawyers and accountants if they are not engaged for compensation as a municipal advisor. And so really the regulators will have their hands tied if an underwriter or whomever goes in and says to the issuer, I am your financial advisor. As long as they're not getting compensation for that, they won't be deemed to have fiduciary duties. And this can be quite troubling for an unsuspecting issuer who you know, at the end of the day, might feel like they did not get a good sale, they won't be able to turn to anybody. They will be left holding the bag, and the taxpayers will be ultimately the ones who have to fit the bill. And so really this is quite troubling. It's not, you know, it's somehow just a clarification of what has been done previously. This is an undoing of Dodd-Frank and will in effect turn us back to a time that existed prior to Dodd-Frank when underwriters could, or anyone else really could act as a financial advisor without having any sort of corresponding fiduciary obligations to the issuer that they're representing.
Okay, great. Frank, do you want to conclude for us?
Hello?
Hey, Frank, we've got you
yes.
now.
Yes, are you able to hear me now? Okay, great. I'm used to being muted, so that's fine. So I just thought I would quickly add two perspectives, one based on history and one based on academic theory about these two issues. The others can talk about the details in much more eloquent ways than I can. But I think it's useful just to remember in historical terms that this is not a new phenomenon. I worked at Morgan Stanley in the mid-1990s, and the municipalities were fish in a barrel for derivatives salespeople and structurers. Selling complex products to municipalities was one of the most profitable parts of the financial services business. And that's gotten only more pronounced in recent years as the rest of the bank industry has gotten so much more competitive and the plain vanilla business is dying. And so I think that's one of the reasons why you've seen such a push to structured product generally, and also with respect to municipalities. The municipal finance business has gotten so much more competitive that simply selling plain vanilla, acting as an underwriter, is not profitable. And so if you work at a municipality now, and a bank is even willing to talk to you, if the people who are financially sophisticated are willing to talk to you, you're probably in grave danger. In the same way people probably remember from the recently deceased Robert Citron in Orange County in the 1990s. And it's not just because of some naive view that the bankers want to rip the faces off their clients, although to some extent individual bankers find it entertaining to sell high-risk products to clients. It's really all just about fees. And I think it's just important to keep in mind that this is not anything new, that it's been around for a long time, and it was an important issue that Congress finally attempted to resolve, at least in part, in Dodd-Frank. And it's been there really over the course of two decades. So for those of you who write about this issue or think about the issue, I think putting it in historical perspective is important. And then the second thing I just wanted to say is just from a big picture perspective, the push for this kind of regulation is not because people feel sorry for municipal treasurers or feel sorry for taxpayers, and we do, but that's not the real reason for the push for this regulation. The reason is much more hard-nosed and about the backbone of a capitalist economy, that the rule of law is an incredibly important part of a well-functioning capital market. And particularly where there's substantial information asymmetry or sophistication asymmetry, we've learned over time in Anglo-American jurisprudence that you need default rules to in those kinds of circumstances where one party has sophisticated information or perspective that the other one doesn't. And there's a kind of sliding scale here. There are some markets that are completely free-for-all, laissez-faire, and then on the other side there are markets where the default rule needs to require the person with better information to look out for the best interests to be really a professional. And there's been a lot of tension in this area, but it's certainly clear that when we're talking about complex products and financial innovation and banks pitching these products to municipalities, that there's at minimum a sufficiently large information and sophistication gap to hold financial advisors to some kind of fiduciary standard. And that's particularly true over the last few years as we've learned from behavioral economics and behavioral finance that simply allowing parties to contract on their own doesn't work, that as smart as municipal employees and treasurers might be, they don't always perfectly know their own preferences. They aren't always able to assess their own preferences. They're subject to some kinds of cognitive errors and bias, and also that there are what academics call agency costs within a municipality, that the senior people might not understand exactly what's happening lower down. And these are the reasons why we have fiduciary duty requirements, so the reasons why we have suitability in general as a kind of default rule. And so I just thought the second issue sometimes tends to get lost. We focus on the granularity of, okay, here there have been a bunch of losses at municipalities, they've been paying large fees, and here's Dodd-Frank. But I think it's important that this is not just some issue involving municipalities. It has, to the extent it involves municipalities, it has a lot of historical breadth. And even beyond municipalities, it's part of this larger issue, which is that historically U.S. capital markets have done so well and been so strong because we have this kind of backbone rule of law that's in part based on closing these information gaps, and that this is really one example of that. So anyway, you invite an academic to be on a call like this, that's the sort of thing you get, but those are my two cents.
And on that issue of the agency problems in municipalities, I'd also just note that the interests of any politician who's in office for 4 years can be very different than the interests of taxpayers when you're signing a 20-year contract that might bring you money in the first couple of years but then have a lot of risks further down the road. So that's another reason you need fiduciary duty. But Marvin, can you unmute the people's line so we can proceed with questions?
Sure, the lines have been unmuted. Those who would like to ask any questions of our speakers, please announce yourself and then direct your question to one of our speakers or more. The call has been unmuted. Are there any questions?
Hi, this is Evan Weinberger from Law 360. Is this an issue where FSOC could step in and push the SEC to move on municipal regulations similar to what it's doing with money markets?
Well, FSOC does have the power to step in on issues if all the members decide that it's appropriate, but I think because FSOC is really has such heavy representation from the prudential agencies, the OCC, the FDIC, and the Federal Reserve, and I don't think they've traditionally seen their role as being policing fair dealing in the markets. They've seen their role more as preventing bank runs. I would sort of just doubt whether they would get involved in something like this. It's more traditionally the SEC's area. I think in the case of money market funds, there was a feeling that the potential for a run on money market funds could have brought down the entire banking sector because so much short-term bank funding was being provided by money market funds, and that's why the FSOC stepped in. This issue, which I think is also an extraordinarily serious issue, is just not an area where the prudential regulators traditionally step in. They're actually a little conflicted in cases where you know banks are doing things that rip off customers but get more money for banks because you know that doesn't necessarily threaten the bank's bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is John Hemmerdinger from the Bond Buyer. What about the argument that there are stronger swap regulations now after Dodd-Frank? And I think some of those swap regulations actually specifically apply to swap dealers dealing with municipalities. I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, you came to the right place for that, because AFR has been fighting that battle on the swap dealer business conduct rules for quite a while now. And the short answer is that the swap dealers managed to roll back the business conduct standards and the fiduciary duty in Title VII of Dodd-Frank, and we feel they actually got the agencies to really almost go against the statute. Basically, what they were able to do is say that that the fiduciary duty for the Title VII fiduciary duty under the business conduct standards in Title VII can be negated through disclosure. In other words, if a swap dealer goes to a municipality and says, "You understand that we don't owe you a fiduciary duty," and then the municipality signs that piece of paper, then the swap dealer is out of the fiduciary duty. And there are some requirements to hire an independent advisor, even if the person gets out of the fiduciary duty, but the independent advisor is not really independent. There really aren't strong requirements that the independent advisor not have a financial connection to the swap dealer. So we just feel that those rules in Title VII have basically been gutted, and the protection that we really need to rely on here is these municipal advisor rules. And in fact, I would sort of say the opposite of your question, that the municipal advisor rules have become more important because of what happened on the Title VII conduct rules for special entities. So they're even more significant now.
Any other questions?
Either on the rule, the SEC has been saying it will finalize its rule within the next couple, you know, hopefully shortly, within the next month or two possibly, or on legislation.
Any thoughts about, it's John Hemmerdinger again, any thoughts about what that rule might look like, the definition coming from the SEC?
Well, I think that they did a very good job in their proposed rule on what we see as the core issue, which is maintaining activity-based fiduciary duty as opposed to status-based. In other words, basing the fiduciary duty on the activity of giving advice as opposed to, you know, whether I happen to work for Morgan Stanley or whether I'm an independent advisor. We hope that they will not change that. It seems from some things they've said that they're going to get rid of the fiduciary duty, get rid of the advisor status for members of elected or appointed boards, which right there addresses all the problems from colleges and universities and many local politicians. It gets, you know, most of the comment letters they got were about that, and they're going to get rid of that, it looks like, entirely. And I think they're also going to be clearer about the distinction between providing information and advice. I mean, it was never the case that providing information, telling someone the interest rate on your CD or telling someone the price you were quoting for something was providing advice. I mean, that's an obvious difference. But I think they could have explained that better, and I think they will. Nathan, I know you've been following this closely. Do you have any thoughts about what direction they're going?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've pretty much summed it up. They're going to get rid of the 1,200-plus comment letters they received relating to appointed and elected officials being deemed municipal advisors. And you know, my understanding that the SEC has some smart individuals working for them who are well within their comfort zone to handle the issues relating to concerns from the underwriting community. you know, that is barring a passage of this particular bill.
Okay.
Hi, this is Ben Weil from CQ. I know in the last Congress, H.R. 2827 was amended by the Financial Services Committee and then passed by the House. Do you know if is the new bill the same as the original version or the amended bill?
The new bill is essentially identical to the amended bill. We feel that the amended bill was really not much of an improvement on the original bill. The original bill just would have exempted banks generally, full stop. The amended bill used that related to or connected with language that I mentioned. In other words, said if you're a bank, if you're a dealer, if you're an underwriter, if you're a swap dealer, you're not going to be regulated for any advice you give that is at all related to or connected with the underwriting, the swap deal, or any traditional bank services, so long as you don't ask for separate compensation for that advice. So, you know, as long as an underwriter is smart enough not to actually make you sign a separate contract for the advisor role, it shouldn't be a problem for them to get out under this amended language because, you know, most advice would be seen by court as related to or connected with the underwriting. So we don't feel the amended version solved the problem at all, and we feel like the bill was kind of rushed through, and I'm not sure people understood the implications of what they were voting for. So the one that has been reintroduced is the amended language, and we continue to oppose.
I'm sorry, who's this speaking?
Oh, it's Marcus Stanley from Americans for Financial Reform.
Thanks, Marcus. And just maybe a follow-up, are there, you know, it passed in the House, as you said, I think, on a voice vote, but then didn't get anywhere in the Senate. Are you communicating to Democratic backers of Dodd-Frank that, you know, this bill is a problem in the House and the Senate?
Yeah, we are. We sent up an opposition letter to the bill to staff generally, and, you know, this press call was obviously publicized to staffers as well, and we've had private conversations with people too. And this is, you know, this is not a simple area. I mean, the core issue is simple, but some of the language that you know, SIFMA and others supporting H.R. 797 have used is not simple. So there's some education to be done, I think, but I think people are receptive to this message, and they're going to, you know, there's going to be more time to consider the implications of this bill than there was in the last Congress.
Right, but this is not simply a Democrat versus Republican issue. I mean, this is an amalgam of strangeness that goes well beyond political parties, because in essence, you've got Republicans and Democrats putting out a bill that would deregulate the same people who, you know, caused the financial crisis. And in so doing, there is a direct link between the type of issuance that is promulgated by these entities, which is a negotiated sale, and the interest rates that are associated with it. So basically, passage of this bill, in effect, will cause more negotiated sales with solely underwriters. And when that happens, the taxpayers and the rates that they pay to their local governments will go up.
And Ben, by the way, if you haven't seen the opposition letter we have, get in touch with us and we'll be happy to send it along.
Are there any other questions for our speakers? Any final comments from our speakers before we conclude? Well, I believe this concludes the call. We want to thank everybody for joining. We did have some technical difficulties earlier with some people unable to join the call, but the call is recorded, and we will make that information available to
all of you on how to access the recording. Again, thank you all for joining today's briefing.